You're listening to Mobile Bunny by Moomoo, demystifying markets one episode at a time. This content is strictly for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be interpreted as a recommendation or investment guidance. Keep in mind that this information is not personalized and should not be the sole basis for your investment decisions, as there may be additional factors to consider.
Welcome to Mobile Money by Moomoo. I'm your host, Justin Zaks, Vice President of Strategy at Moomoo Technologies. I've spent my whole career in and around financial markets. This is a show that helps investors gain a better understanding of markets and their money. Some money rules have stood the test of time, while others from your parents' or grandparents' generation may now be outdated. Today, I will explore some of the most popular money rules in depth to divide myth from reality. You may have heard that a lot of money experts tell you that you need to have exactly 6 months of expenses in an emergency fund. Let's break that down a little bit. Do we really need to have exactly that much? Is it the same for everyone? For the median family, the average income is about $75,000 a year, and they spend almost all of that, about $67,000 a year. That breaks down to about $5,500 per month. That's a lot of money going in, going out. And so where is that savings going to come from? And obviously, if you need 6 months of expenses, you're talking for the average family an amount around $35,000 or maybe $34,000. That's a lot of money. So does the average family actually need $34,000 in an emergency savings fund that you're putting in a savings account? Maybe it's not earning a lot of interest just sitting there. And that's a real question. And nowadays, with all the different financial instruments you have, that might not be the case. Having the savings is important. So we did survey our users and to see, you know, kind of what personal savings they have. And it was pretty interesting, and it was pretty divided across the board as to where our users stood. About 25% of them actually have 6 months or more savings in an emergency account. About 15% have less than 1 month, and 17% have no savings at all. And so to get into it, let's think about what actually constitutes an emergency. Well, it's going to be different for everyone, but let's talk about some of the obvious ones. Medical emergency, home repairs, car repairs, loss of income, and that's probably the biggest one. So in your parents' or grandparents' generation, they may have had their emergency savings in a savings account earning very little interest, or perhaps even in actual cash currency underneath the mattress. And nowadays, it's much different. A lot of people have brokerage accounts. They buy bonds, they buy T-bills, they have money market accounts. So it's not necessarily easy to think of an emergency savings account just in one account. And so let me think about what money you might need easily accessible. Think about probably the worst case scenario for most people is going to be you're going to get laid off from your job. First thing you got to think about is even if you can live off of your unemployment, which is not that much for a lot of families, most families are not going to be able to fund all of their expenses out of unemployment. That unemployment check might not come right away. It usually takes several weeks. By the time you file, you have to wait a week, and then it finally is going to hit your bank account. It could be several weeks. So my thought is you probably need about a month's expenses in a very easy to access account so that you know if I'm laid off, I have at least a month to get going. And then I could say, well, where are my other funds? But that just gets you through the first month. You need to find a job. And you know, sometimes it takes 3-6 months. I've been laid off before, and I know sometimes it's taken me several months to find that new job. So that six-month number then becomes pretty important, but it doesn't mean you have to have it all in a savings account. You can have it in something safe like T-bills, and then you can go ahead and liquidate that investment. In the worst-case scenario, you would have to dip into your brokerage account and liquidate your stocks, but depending where those stocks are and how the stock market does, that becomes a much riskier proposition. So you got to think about how you want to bucket this. But having a minimum of 6 months savings overall is kind of table stakes. That's where you want to start with. So that's a great goal for everyone, depending how you want to divide that up. And you got to think about how accessible is it? How much might those investments move around? How often do I need them? Am I saving for retirement, my kids' education? Those are not emergency savings. So you don't want to be dipping into those. You can dip into something really safe, you know, your quote, rainy day fund. The other area you can go that's not going to be as good for that emergency money you need is something like credit cards or a home equity loan. And you really have to think about this. If you have long-term investments, say in the stock market, in the bond market, do you want to borrow off those credit cards and keep those long-term investments? Or is it better to sell off those long-term investments? And obviously, that's going to vary from person to person and your unique financial situation. But when you do that, it's leverage. You got to think of it as leverage, and it becomes a lot riskier to do that type of thing. You really have to think about, if I'm dipping into my credit cards for a few weeks and I can pay them off, and I know I'm going to get a job in a few weeks, or it's a minor expense. Relative, maybe it's a few thousand and you feel like, well, I can pay that off over a few months, then a credit card might be the right option. You might not want to sell your stocks if you feel there's real value there. But when you're talking about larger amounts, it becomes a much riskier strategy to do. The other thing you really have to think about is your own unique situation. You know, a lot of people had the traditional job before. They had a long-term employer. They might have had one or two employers in their lifetime. Nowadays, people switch jobs, and a lot of people are self-employed. They don't necessarily have health insurance. They're buying that on an exchange. That's, again, a riskier situation. You might need more than 6 months in different accounts when you're self-employed because you have a much greater risk, and then you're more in a situation where the economy can affect your earnings a lot more than if you're in a salaried position, say a government position, where you know you might not get laid off very easily. So everyone's situation is going to be very unique. And that's something you need to think about when you think about these emergency savings. Think about how much risk you have in your own job, in your own finances. The more money you have overall in different accounts, the less money you may need in an emergency savings fund. Think about what your health is like. Think about how often these costs come up, these emergencies. The more they're coming up for you, the more you realize you do need a lot of money in those emergency accounts. So you would have to say that 6 months number is not written in stone, but it is good to have an emergency savings fund. And probably one of the other money maxims that I hear a lot is save for a rainy day. And this is one that I do agree with. You really want to save money for a time when it might be needed unexpectedly. And that's having your emergency savings funds. But it also includes investing wisely, thinking about your retirement, thinking about your education, thinking about your family's education, having insurance. Insurance can be a way to save for a rainy day. So that's another great money maxim that has been around a long time. Another maxim you hear a lot is every penny counts. And I really think you got to take this one with a grain of salt. I always hear, you know, these news reports talking about a lot of the billionaires. So if a billionaire sees a $100 bill on the ground, you know, should that person pick it up or not? Is it worth their time? And you can say the same thing about a penny. If you see a penny on the ground, picking it up and then using it, is it really worth your time? And at some point, that answer is no. And everyone knows with inflation, you know, a penny's not worth what it used to be for our parents' generation or our grandparents' generation, even for a middle-class citizen. And what I like to think about in terms of savings is not necessarily a penny, but start thinking a little bit bigger. You know, everyone talks about that cup of coffee. If you're getting that $5 cup of coffee every day and you're not getting it, and so you're going to save that $5 every day, and that obviously that can add up to a lot of money if you do it every day. And there's little things you can do. But I would rather say let's focus on the big ticket items, because people do want that cup of coffee. And at some point, you have to go out and eat food or buy food or get some of those small items that might be a pleasure in your everyday life. Yes, you can. If you're in financial straits, it's good to cut back on that. But you really got to think about what can I do, say, for your car? So if you go out and buy a $60,000 car and then say, well, maybe I won't do that. I'll buy a $20,000 car. Now you're talking about a huge savings, much more than just a few cups of coffee. So I think penny saved is a penny earned. But at the same point, you know, a $10,000 saved is $10,000 earned. And you got to think of it from that perspective. Part of it is psychological, though. It's when you're not going out and just spending willy-nilly, you're thinking about developing prudent financial habits, not spending frivolously. This can be something that's very valuable. Like whenever you go to make a purchase, think about it. Is this something that improves my life? Is this something I really want? And if the answer is yes, and you can afford it, go and do it. But if it's not, think, well, where can I take that money? What can I do with it? And then once you save it, you got to go a little further on to there. It's not just about the savings. It's once you save it, what are you doing to earn money on your money? Where are you investing it? Are you putting it in, you know, for instance, a Moomoo brokerage account and seeing if you can take that money and grow that money? And that's something you may want to think about. In the movie Fight Club, starring Brad Pitt as Tyler Durden, there's a very famous quote. It's, gentlemen, welcome to Fight Club. The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. With your money, I think there's a lot of people think the same way. Never talk about money. In fact, 62% of Americans don't talk about money. The question first is, why are people not talking about money? And it differs. It's very interesting. It differs by culture. A lot of people outside of America are more apt to talk about money. So maybe if your family is an immigrant family or you identify more with a foreign culture, you're more apt to talk about money. But among a lot of Americans, it's just not talked about. And it's also, interestingly, part of the wage gap. So people that make over $100,000, only 17% of those parents tell or plan to tell their children how much they earn or about their net worth. Meanwhile, people that make a lot less money or more likely to talk about money. So I think there is definitely this idea that people are being judged by how much money they make or how much money they've saved. And that's not necessarily the way we should be thinking about it. Personal worth is a lot more than your financial worth, and you should not be equating one with the other. Because ultimately, talking about money with your family and your friends actually can be very beneficial. Think about this. People talk about their marital problems. They talk about mental health now. I mean, that's something that's in the last few years has become very more openly talked about. People talk about sex and politics, much more controversial subjects than money. So just because you don't want to be judged doesn't mean you shouldn't be talking about money, particularly with your children. Think about how hard it is if you're growing up, and certainly they're not teaching this in school. So you get out there and you don't know enough about money as a young person in college. You're just out of college. And a lot of that has to do with you're not getting the proper education from your family. You don't know about how to budget. You don't really understand the value of a dollar. And a lot of the best parenting can be teaching your kids about giving them an allowance and saying, here's some money, here's the value of a dollar, here's how much we make, here's how much other people make, and this is why you're lucky, or this is why you have to value money. Because a lot of people end up where they just don't have an understanding of how money works, and then they end up having financial problems as an adult. Talking about money can help you define your goals. It can help you with your budget. It sets expectations. Can reduce stress and anxiety. It can enable some of that emotional support. And you can learn stuff. You can learn financial tips. I just think about the Moomoo community and how a user can go in there and learn from what other people are doing. And the best part about talking about your finances is as long as you're non-judgmental, you can learn from people that are doing it right and doing it wrong, because both of those examples are something that you can take something from. And I'm always thinking, because I've made a lot of mistakes and I've had some successes, and I'm sure all our users out there have done so financially. But just because you are in a certain situation doesn't mean you can't improve, doesn't mean you can't learn from people out there in talking about it. Because when you talk about it, you're going to reduce that stress level and you're going to be better off for it in the long run. Another money maxim you hear often is, if you're not a financial professional, you need someone else to manage your money. guess where these maxims probably come from? Money managers. Another one I probably disagree with. Being active and taking control of your financial future can be very empowering. And it all starts with education, and it can be daunting, but getting that financial education, taking it step by step, having a self-directed trading account like Moomoo is one step that can get you to financial freedom. And everyone, even if you have someone that manages your money, and maybe you don't want to dive all in 100% one way to, you know, doing it all yourself, you still have to choose that person. You still have to have that understanding. So you just can't be an ostrich and bury your head in the sand about your finances, because they count so much. And as you get older, it's even more important. Just think, the more money you have, the more money you might possibly earn from that money, and the money you're earning at your job is less. It counts more. And so the people going into their retirement, going into their kids' education, the savings count so much. And so having prudent and responsible financial literacy, it's just so important nowadays. I mean, most mutual funds can't beat the S&P 500 long term. So when you're putting it with that financial professional, you're going to be paying fees. So you have to make back the fees, and they have to be a better investment guru than the index itself, because you could just put it in, you know, index products that have very low fees if this is something that you want to do over the long term. Meanwhile, a lot of people say set it and forget it. You can take that money, and that's one way to do it. But being more active with your finances, you need periodic review. You have to think about it from the standpoint of, this is your future, and you want to review your future, and you want to keep learning. If you were to do this in other parts of your education, you know, it would never work out for you. Say, well, I learned this one thing one day, I'm never going to review it, I'm never going to look over it again. I mean, that's just not going to work, and it's not going to work for your finances either. You know, you're not going to have someone else tell you who to marry. You're not going to have someone else tell you this is the job you should take. And you shouldn't have someone tell you these are all the investment decisions you should make in your life. You really need to take control of your financial future. Some of you out there are probably doing pretty well, and you're saying, well, I have enough money, I don't need a budget. And that's another maxim that comes up often. And so, and again, another one I don't necessarily agree with. Just because you're meeting your expenses doesn't mean you don't need a budget. You don't, maybe don't need to break it down to every single dollar like someone that's on a much tighter budget, but you do need to think about those big purchases, because it can be something that could sink you if you're not aware. You got to think, well, what's coming up for my retirement? What's coming up for my education? How much housing can I really afford? These big categories matter. And budgeting matters not only to see where your money's going, but to help you set goals, help you to save. Say, I want to save X percentage of my income. These are goals that you can set. And when you set a budget, it helps you set these goals, and it makes it easier to achieve those goals and make the most out of every dollar. And nowadays, some of this small minutia is easier because you have auto pay and direct deposit. So you can set up payments for your monthly recurring bills, and you could see the money come in and out of your account very easily. So you're not always looking at it right away, but you can go and review it and say, well, the budgeting part of it's a little easier because I'm not going through every single line item every single month, but I have a general idea. So if you have a good amount of money, you still want to look and say, what is that electric bill? Am I doing well with that? Do a periodic review every quarter and say, where do I look at my expenses? How am I spending more than I usually spent? How's my income side looking? How's my investments doing? It's, again, you constantly want to be reviewing your total financial portfolio, your total financial picture, to see how you're doing so that you could take that budget and continue to grow. Another myth that might have been true in the 70s or before that is a single income stream is enough. Nowadays, the idea of having one employer for life or having a guaranteed pension, those are gone for most people. You know, very few people have, you know, that luxury. Now, the gig economy is here. Many people are self-employed. Many people have multiple income streams. That does help you diversify. It does give you options. So having multiple income streams nowadays is almost a given for many people. And it's so important, given inflation, given how much everything costs, just having that one job and saying, I'm going to rely on this one job and not think about how can I make some extra money? Or even if that money comes from investing, say, I want to have a portfolio that pays a certain amount of dividends. You're going to take some of your W-2 income, put it into an account, and then say, let's see what I can do to generate some income from my investments. These are all income streams that you can use in different ways to give you that security that you need. That's not necessarily there like it was for your grandparents who had a pension, who worked for a company for 30 years. It's just really not the way things are done anymore. One belief I think a lot of the older generation holds is that a college degree is going to be a guarantee to financial success. Again, I think that's really outdated. And think about when a lot of these people were getting their degree. I'll give you some statistics. In 1960, 7.7% of the U.S. population above age 25 had a college degree. That number is now almost 38%. So back then, you were somewhat of a rarity if you had a college degree and you had a much greater path to success. But nowadays, so many people have a college degree. It's no longer a guarantee. And you really need to carve out your own path. College is not for everyone. It can be a great way to get certain types of jobs. But if you really want to be in the trades, you want to be an electrician or a plumber, you don't necessarily need a college degree. And these trades can be very well paid, a lot of times more well paid than college. And if you're going to college and you're going to be a D student or a C student and it's not for you and you come out of there, you're not going to have the skills you need to pay back those student loans. And that's another myth a lot of people think, well, if I'm taking out a student loan, that's good debt and I'm going to be able to pay it back. And that's not necessarily the case. You know, if you're hitting it out of the park and you're going to go into a high paying career and you're number one in your class, yes, it's a great investment. Taking that student loan is going to be worth its while. But the same person that's a D student that's majoring in areas that might not have a lot of jobs or might have a lot of low paying jobs that might be minimum wage, even out of college, or might not be well paid down the road. It's going to take you a long time to pay those loans. These loans are going out 10 years, and it could set you back quite a long time. So it's something you really need to think about when you're deciding, well, am I going to go to college? Do I want to take out these student loans? Do I want to go to a really expensive school, or are there alternatives? Are there state schools? Are there community colleges that might better serve my needs? And it's very difficult to make these decisions at 17 or 18 years old. And again, this goes back to what I talked about before, never talk about money. And this is, you should be talking with this with your friends and your family who've been there, who've gone through it. You want to think about what they've done, and they're going to be able to help you make some of these decisions, because going to college is an admirable goal, but it's not for everyone. And it really needs to be thought out in terms of finances. Is that money that you're foregoing during those 4 years and the additional debt you're piling on, how long is it going to take you to make that back? And everyone's going to have a different answer, but it's an exercise everyone should take. And out of college, the other maxim you hear a lot is follow your passion. And so a lot of times that can be good advice, but it's not always. You know, a lot of times you might not be good at your passion. It might not be able to pay the bills. So you have to think about that. It doesn't mean you can't use that passion as a hobby. You know, think about what you're good at. And if what you're good at is also your passion and it pays well, then you've kind of hit the jackpot. But it's not going to be that way for everyone. It's, you know, it's something to think about. Another thing a lot of people talk about is, and they'll tell you, a lot of the older people that have had one job, that have two jobs, don't switch jobs very often. It's not good. It looks bad on your resume. But nowadays, a lot of times that's the way you can get a significant pay raise. A lot of times companies are unwilling to promote or give you a significant pay raise because they have you kind of locked in. And so one of the ways you can figure out what your net worth is on the market is just go out there and say, well, maybe someone else is willing to pay me more. And a lot of times you can get that promotion when you go externally. So it's something to think about. You don't necessarily need a super high income, high paying job to become a millionaire. You get that college degree or not, that money that you can save is a lot of times more important than the income you're making. So when you're saving, when you're taking that money and it's growing over the long term and it's compounding, that's something that can give even, people that are teachers can become millionaires. And a lot of people don't think that. But if you save prudently, if you invest wisely, this is the path to financial freedom in the long term. Cash is trash. I hear this saying a lot from the pundits on many financial networks. And the idea is you should always be invested in stocks because they're always going to return better than cash. And that's not necessarily true. At some point, stocks can become wildly overvalued and their future expected returns may not be as good as cash. And it's something to think about. You got to think about, when do I need that money? If you need it 40 years from now, it's a lot different than if you need it 4 years from now. And when they're talking about that cash, what do they actually mean? Cash is trash. They're not talking about putting cash under your mattress, actual physical currency, because that actually is not necessarily a good idea. Because when you put that money in a bank or a money market account, you're going to earn some interest. Otherwise, inflation's going to eat away at the value of that money. And it's probably not that safe under your mattress anyway. There could be a fire. You could be robbed. Much rather have that money in a bank that's guaranteed by the FDIC up to $250,000. Think about this. 10 years ago, interest rates were close to zero. And at that point, cash may have been trash, meaning you could get a much better return in the stock market because you weren't getting very much with your cash. But nowadays, you're getting 4 or 5%. That becomes a much bigger hurdle. It's harder to get that return year in, year out from the stock market, particularly a stock market that's near our all-term highs. When you think about, well, where's my money going to be 3-4 years from now if I can earn 4 or 5% on my cash and I need the money? If you need the money in something, put it in something safe. Cash is not necessarily the worst option. And you don't have to be all cash and you don't have to be all stocks. It's something a lot of people are like, well, I either want to be all in or all out. And so you can have some balance. And so we talked about emergency funds before. So some of that money should be in cash for that emergency fund because stuff will come up in your life. And if you have it all in stocks, you never know where those stocks are going to go. There is some risk there. Let's talk about housing. I think there's so much advice people love to give about housing, whether they're an expert or not. And I think one of the most common things you'll hear from a lot of people is buying is always better than renting. And that's something that's not necessarily always true. You really have to think of it in terms of how much would it cost to rent what you're buying, and how much is that, house or home going to appreciate over the long run. There's so much that goes into it. Obviously, owning a home gives you a lot of flexibility. You can renovate, but at the same point, it can be much more expensive. And nowadays, that is the case for a lot of people. In some cases, I've seen studies recently that said buying is now about 50% more expensive than renting on average in the U.S. And in some markets, it's obviously a lot more. So it's something to think about. You really have to weigh the financial decision and also think about, how long am I going to be in my home? The longer you're in the home, the better it is financially, because you don't have to pay these huge transaction costs. So if you're going to move in a year or two, renting is probably the best option most of the time. If you're going to be there 30 years, well, you're talking about a different type of story. And I would tell everyone to check out the podcast, Housing's Hot Streak, from December. I talk a lot about why the housing prices are still so high, given that interest rates have gone up. It's really a fascinating dichotomy that's going on in the market right now. And then everyone will always tell you, well, if you're renting, you're just throwing money away. And when you're buying, it's very similar in a lot of ways. You're only the principal that you're paying down is equity that you're building up. All the mortgage interest, that's money that's gone. All the maintenance, all your taxes, you're not going to see that money again. That's the cost of living. And it's the same as rent. And a lot of people don't realize that. It is a forced savings. And that's what you've got to think about. So if you are renting, you're not building up equity in a home. So you need to take some of that money that you're saving, right, from renting and put it into a brokerage account, put it in stocks, put it in bonds, put it in investments. And contrary to popular belief, at least in the past, stocks have outperformed housing. And you know, people tell you, well, housing is always a good investment. It never goes down. And that's not always the case. And we saw that in 2006, 2007, 2008. A lot of markets got cut in half across the country. So it's a big investment too. Think you're leveraging a lot of this, you know, this money. And so even if you put 20% down, and everyone says, well, you have to put 20% down. And that's again, depends on your, you know, financial situation. There are situations where if that's all you have is 20%, it might be better to put 15 or 10 down and save some money for an emergency fund. If you have a significant income that's able to pay that down, you do have to worry about emergencies and repairs and things like that. And then when you do have a mortgage, a lot of people will tell you, oh, you have to, you know, paying down your mortgage early, that's always the best investment to do. And nowadays, it might be one of the worst because so many people have mortgages at 2.5%, 3.5%. And now that mortgage rates are 7%, you can get 4.5% or 5% on your cash. It's one of the worst things you can do, because if you're going to be borrowing at 3%, you don't want to pay that out when you can earn 4.5% or 5% risk-free in a money market account or short-term T-bills. Something to think about. Now, if you do have a mortgage and you just got it, and it's 7%, well, now you're earning that 7%. That's a different story. So you have to look at your individual situation when it comes to housing. We talked about mortgage debt. Let's talk about other types of debt. I mean, there's this other maxim that says all debt is bad. And that's, again, not necessarily the case. We've talked about a little bit about each of these types of debt. Mortgage debt is not necessarily bad when you can afford it, and it helps you get into the home you want. Very few people can pay all cash for a home. They do need a mortgage, and it helps you build wealth over time. Investing your education, if you're a good student and you're fiscally responsible, this can be student debt can be good. If you're starting a business and you need a business loan to grow your business, these can be good debt. So not all debt is necessarily bad. And what about credit cards? I think credit cards can be very controversial among a lot of people. And there's some people that say, well, you know, credit cards are, you know, horrible. You should always pay with cash. And it's not necessarily the case. And it's about being responsible. But credit cards, you can get sucked in if you're not careful. It's like if you carry a balance, you're going to be paying huge interest in the 20% range. But if you're paying it off every month, you pay zero interest. So you're getting a loan. And a lot of times these credit cards come with benefits. So if you have a budget, if you're being fiscally responsible, credit cards are not always the worst thing. The other part that people think about is, you know, I want to have credit cards and I want to carry a balance because it helps you build credit. And I think there's some confusion around there. It's the idea of having the credit available can help you build that credit. Meaning just having the card itself and paying it off in full every month, that can help you. But carrying the balance doesn't necessarily help you because you're only paying that small minimal amount. You're paying large interest. That's not necessarily an area you want to be in to build your credit. You can get a credit card to help build your credit. You want to have a nice credit limit. You want to use that credit card, but try to pay it off in full every month. And then you're doing the right thing. You're getting a small short-term loan for 0% interest when you do that. It can be 20, 25 days. And on top of that, you're building up your credit score. And that's the great way to be with credit cards is to be fiscally responsible. It's not for everyone. A lot of people don't want to handle it that way, are not able to have the discipline that's needed. And sometimes you say, well, that's fine. That's not for me. And you can use a debit card. You can have your bank and you say, well, I don't need credit cards. You don't need credit cards to exist. A lot of times I hear people also talk about credit cards with regards to paying them off. They say, well, always start with your small debts and then that will help you conquer the big ones. And that's, again, not necessarily the smartest idea. You really have to think about what the interest rates are. If your small debts have 2% interest and your big debts have 20% interest, it just doesn't make any sense to pay off those small debts first. Psychologically, it can be very good for you. So, well, I conquered one credit card, but I'm now moving on to the next one. But financially, it's not going to help you. So you want to think about what is that interest rate, and you want to start from the highest interest rate on down to the lowest interest rate. In most cases, that's going to be the best for you in the long term. But getting on that path is most important. People, you may already be in that situation where you have a lot of debts, a lot of credit card debts. You can always start today. You can always say, I'm going to get out there and think about how I want to start paying those debts down and getting on the path to financial freedom. Pleasure to speak to all of you today about some of the money myths. And I'd love to hear what everyone thought about the podcast. Please write that in the comments. Do you agree with what I've said, or do you agree with some of these money maxims or not? Love to hear from you. Until next week, this has been Justin Zacks. Take care.
The opinions expressed are those of the host and any guest speaker and not necessarily those of Moomoo Technologies, Inc. or its affiliates. The podcast is provided for informational and educational purposes only and is not a recommendation or endorsement of any particular investment or investment strategy that may be mentioned or covered in the podcast. All investments involve risk and the loss of principal as possible. Past performance does not indicate or guarantee future success. Moomoo is not affiliated with any outside guests or their companies. Information provided in this podcast is general in nature and may not be appropriate for all investors. The Moomoo app is an online trading platform offered by Moomoo Technologies, Inc. Securities, brokerage products, and related services available through the Moomoo app are offered by Moomoo Financial, Inc., a member of FINRA, SIPC.